The long exhausting fasts, the lonely vigils, intended to subjugate the flesh, served only to weaken the tie between it and the spirit to such a degree that it was no longer possible for the spirit to impress upon the body a clear picture of what it beheld. If it did so at all, it was as a broken and imperfect communication, which resembled in its grotesqueness the jumbled pieces of some puzzle picture shaken together in any fashion. To obtain a true communication from the spirit to the body, when the spirit has so far detached itself as to be able to wander away into the spirit world on its own account and penetrate the mysteries of spirit life, it requires that body and spirit shall be in perfect working order and in possession of the best of its powers. Otherwise the earthly body becomes like a hard lump of clay, instead of a pliable wax-like mold, capable of receiving the impress of the spiritual brain at the moment of its return to the earthly envelope. If the impression is not at once conveyed, a more recent sensation will take its place, and the first idea, if stamped upon the brain at all, will become confused with the second one, and thus become imperfect and misleading. A body in perfect health and in perfect touch with the soul inhabiting it, is soft, warm, and pliable, as all can feel for themselves. A body, which is dead, is rigid and cold, and no longer capable of expressing the soul's emotions or experiences, because it is no longer capable of having the stamp of these feelings engraved like a picture upon the tablets of the earthly brain. And a body weakened by starvation is a body partially dead, in a greater or less degree, and therefore not able to receive a clearly stamped impression of purely spiritual things. It should be remembered that while it is attached in any way to the earthly envelope, the soul has to draw its nourishment through the organism of the earthly body, and from mortal things it must extract the spiritual essence wherewith to renew the spiritual substance of its spiritual body, even as the earthly body is renewed and sustained by earthly food, so that if the earthly envelope is starved, the soul suffers with it, and is thereby weakened. Without doubt it is a fatal error to overindulge the earthly body, but it is no less fatal error to neglect or starve it, for it is the true adjustment of an equal balance between the animal and spiritual halves of the soul, which is needful to afford the best conditions under which to study spiritual things, and to receive spiritual revelations. Thus it will be seen how great is the error of supposing that it is necessary to starve the earthly body in order to subdue it and prevent it from hampering the immortal soul. Oh! Great is the folly of man in imagining that he can improve upon God's handiwork, or that if the cravings of the material body serve only as a clog upon the higher aspirations of man's soul, the supreme wisdom would have endowed him with such a body at all. Chapter 4, My Flight from the Temple. To a youth such as I was, full of life and exuberant spirits, with a vigorous constitution and an impetuous and vehement temper, the life of the temple soon became insupportable. I was at an age when the blood is warm, and courses swiftly through the veins, and the passions are strong, requiring to be educated and regulated, not simply suppressed. I required a life of action, and I thirsted for love and friendship, and they condemned me to a loveless, joyless stagnation, which might have suited soul valetudinarian whose days of action were over, and whose blood was cold and sluggish, and who only sought a peaceful resting place wherein to await the great change. I hungered for knowledge, and they gave me crumbs of mystic lore, that left me starving and ignorant as before. I was full of the wildest ambitions, the keenest desire for power, and they sought to make my mind and body alike subject to the will and caprices of petty tyrants, whose narrow lives and cramped dogmatic minds unfitted them to control the destiny of the meanest slave. They starved my soul. They cramped my thoughts. They well nigh extinguished life itself in pursuit of their pet theories and in their attempt to train me down to think and see as they did. As well might they have taken a young eaglet from its lofty mountain nest and sought to make it lead the life of a barn dwarf owl. What wonder then that my soul revolted, and that being strong in mind as well as body I could not submit, like many of the unhappy neophytes around me, to sink into a mere tool, a poor shadow of other men's thoughts. At first I wrestled with myself, and strove to be content. I thought it was the temptations of devils, which assailed me with this giant discontent. But my clear intellect could not thus be satisfied with a sophism, a formula, doled out to all those whose minds revolted from a state of existence for which they were unsuited, and I grew at last to be so desperate in my desire for freedom that right or wrong, I vowed I would be free. No man, be he priest or layman, should shackle me. When the timber is dry, it wants but a spark to start a great conflagration, and a mere spark, a chance word spoken in the grave, pompous, monotonous tones of the high priest was enough to fan my smouldering revolt into flame. He thought fit to reprove me for some trifling lapse of duty, and I answered him, to his astonishment and anger. He quickly imposed a penance of so many days of fasting and solitude, whereon I told him that I would not obey him, that I hated the temple and its rules, and I hated him. I would go forth to be free. Free. In great troth he told me such a thing was impossible, none who enter the temple's walls ever leave them again to return to the life of ordinary men, O vain and presumptuous youth. A temper like unto your needs much discipline to subdue it, and here there are means strong enough to do so, and those who have the power to use them. Great is the penance such discontent as your doth merit, such blindness to the blessings and privileges you hast enjoyed deserves severe punishment, and shall receive it. Terrible is the fate, which you hast incurred by your impious discontent and desire to quit the service of the temple, yea, even death itself had been awarded for such words as you hast spoken. He delivered himself of these words in a hard, rasping, monotonous voice, and his manner and cruel want of sympathy with my feelings so maddened me that, excited as I already was, I turned upon him, and trembling in every limb with passion, sought to push past him and leave the little cell. But he barred the way, and tried to thrust me back. Whereon, reckless now in my revolt, I struck him to the earth, and stepping over his prostrate body fled for dear life, well knowing what penalty must await one whose sacrilegious hand had struck down a priest. I met no one on my way to the gates, for it was the hour at which most of the inmates of the temple were at private meditation or reposing. The gates were shut fast, and for a moment I thought that I was lost. Then I beheld a tree whose branches hung over the wall low enough for me to reach them with an active spring, and soon I had swung myself by their aid onto the wall and dropped down on the other side. I then ran for dear life, on and on, stopping neither to look back nor where I was going, only thankful that there were no signs of pursuit behind me. For some hours I ran on, and at last, overcome by exhaustion, I stopped and gazed around me. I was among great mountains, whose dark passes and many precipices might easily afford me a hiding place. How far from the temple I was, I could not guess, but from the efforts I had made and the number of hours I had struggled on, I thought it must be far behind me. Whether I had killed the priest, or only stunned him, I did not much care, I was still too angry to think much of it. And as I gazed up at the clear starlit sky above me, and watched the glittering canopy studded with its myriad sparkling gems of light, a wild feeling of exultation filled my soul, for I was free at last. Chapter 5, The Tribesmen of the Hills. I was so much exhausted by my exertions that, feeling myself in comparative safety, I lay down upon the ground and was soon fast asleep. The sun was already high in the heavens ere I woke, and with my return to consciousness my naturally healthy appetite asserted its claims with so much persistence that I was fain to risk the danger of discovery and seek for someone from whom I could buy food. I had lain down upon a mountainside to sleep, and below me there lay a wide valley wherein a herd of sheep and goats were browsing, while the herdsman's tent could be distinguished almost directly beneath the spot on which I stood. I had no money, and nothing of value to offer in exchange for such things as I desired, save the gold chain I wore round my neck. From this, by the aid of a sharp stone, I broke off two of the massive links, and then made my way into the valley. The herdsman was absent, but his wife, after a brisk barter between us, agreed to give me a suit of her husband's clothes and some goat's milk and cakes in exchange for my gold links. I felt sure the woman was cheating me and giving me very little for what I gave her, but her many questions embarrassed and alarmed me, and I was anxious to hurry on once more. As soon as I had got fairly out of sight of the valley, I sat down and ate ravenously, then, putting on the shepherd's clothes, I made my neophyte's dress, which I knew would betray me and make it easy to trace my flight, into a bundle, and looked about the most effectual means of disposing it. I was near the edge of a precipitous mountain gorge, at the bottom of which I could dimly discern a small streamlet rushing over its rocky bed. As it appeared practically inaccessible, I resolved to throw my clothes down there, and in order to make them fall the more securely, I filled the bundle with lumps of rock, tying them up as well as I could, and then threw them over. In my haste I had not tied them very securely, and as they fell, some of the stones tumbled out, lightening the bundle so much that instead of hanging straight down, as I had hoped, they were caught by the wind and blown onto a ledge of rock about halfway down, where they lay half spread out, and looking, to my chagrin, remarkably like a figure, which had fallen over the precipice. I was so much disturbed by this mishap that I thought of climbing down to dislodge them, but I soon found this was impossible, owing to the steepness of the overhanging rocks, and I was obliged to go on and leave them where they lay. Little did I guess that to this incident, I was to owe at once my immunity from pursuit and the loss of a valuable protector. As I had left the Shepherd's Valley in a westerly direction, I now resolved to double back, and passing behind it again to make my way towards the south, hoping that if the shepherd's wife had watched me, she would thus be thrown off the trail. For 2 days I journeyed on, resting for a few hours in the heat of the day and at night, and then hurrying on again. On the evening of the second day, I found myself among a low range of foothills, beyond which lay a sandy desert. Here I resolved to lie down and rest before attempting to cross it. I had not slept long before I was rudely awakened by the glare of torches held before my eyes, and the loud whisperings of about a dozen rough-looking men who had just discovered me. I tried to spring up and escape, but was at once seized, and a couple of long knives are brandished within an inch of my face, while a torrent of abuse, in the barbarous dialect of one of the hill tribes, was poured upon me. Seeing that resistance was worse than useless, I resigned myself to my fate, relieved in part to find that these men were at least not emissaries of the priests sent to capture me. They were very angry at finding nothing of value upon me, for I had taken the precaution of hiding my gold chain in the high-peaked sheepskin cap I had got from the herdsman's wife. After feeling me all over several times without any result, I heard them begin to discuss the advisability of cutting my throat and throwing me over the rocks, or else taking me as a captive to the chief, and I thought it high time to put in a word upon my own behalf. So I said, "Be not so angry, O friends, that I have nothing of value upon me wherewith to reward you for capturing me. Rather give me your pity, since I am a poor fugitive who has fled from one danger only to encounter another still greater. Behold, I am as a field of stubble that had been well reaped already, and which has nothing left to reward the labors of the after-gleaners." "By the powers of evil, you art right," said one, "yet even stubble is useful to burn, and you shall be set to work for us if there is no other use we can put you to. Who art you, and whence hast you fled?" I thought within myself that half a truth is better than a whole lie, so I replied, "I am a youth who has struck his master, and thus was I obliged to fly." At this they laughed, and one struck me upon the back playfully, yet somewhat too hard to be pleasant, saying, "Hast you done that? Then it was well done, and who knows but that there may be good and useful stuff in you, after all. We will take you to our chief, and he shall decide your fate." Saying which, they proceeded to bind me hand and foot, and having mounted me upon a horse they turned away from the desert and rode through the hills for some time. At last, just as the sun arose, we paused at the entrance to a high rocky gorge, and as I looked up to greet the rising orb of day I breathed an earnest prayer for deliverance from this new danger. Here they bandaged my eyes and lifted me from the horse, leading me, as I could feel, up a steep pathway, which wound up and down for some distance, and at last, after much stumbling and slipping, owing to my being unable to see where I was stepping, I found myself upon level ground once more. The bandage was now taken from my eyes, and I found myself on the edge of a very wide plateau high up among the hills. A great many handsome tents were dotted about the grassy plain, and many sheep, goats, and camels were quietly feeding there, while a number of handsome horses were tethered before their owners' tents, making altogether quite a gay and prosperous scene. As we approached the largest and most richly decorated tent, a young girl came out, carrying a smoking dish of lamb's meat and freshly cooked rice. She stopped to look at us, and especially favored me with a glance from her black eyes, which made my heart, unused as I was to the society of women, beat with great rapidity. I bowed low to the girl as I returned her look, and did my best to make my eyes express what my lips did not dare to utter. Whether by accident or design, I do not know, but at this juncture her veil became disarranged, and ere she had replaced it, I had obtained a very fair glimpse of her face, with its full red lips, plump chin, and pink-tinted cheeks, and as she hastily gathered the veil together I was ushered into the presence of the chief, a large, powerful, and decidedly fat and coarse-looking man in gaudy raiment, plundered no doubt from some luckless caravan. To his interrogations as to who I was, I told the same tale as before, only suppressing the fact that my master had been a priest, for I feared that the superstitious dread, which even these wild, lawless men felt for the priesthood, would render them unwilling to shelter me if they knew that I had fled from a temple. I had resolved to throw myself upon the generosity of the robbers, and to ask permission to remain for a time with them, should I see that there was any fair prospect of my request being granted. I argued that since I was myself an outlaw and a fugitive, I was more likely to find a safe asylum among men who were also outside the pale of the law than anywhere else. How matters might have gone with me I do not know, but as I was telling my story, the chief's daughter, who proved to be the girl I had seen outside, came in, and having listened to my recital, was so much prepossessed in my favor, as to interpose with her father on my behalf, and to such good effect that I was offered the choice of being set at liberty or of joining the band and becoming one of these marauders myself. I need hardly say that I at once chose the latter alternative, as I could see I was fully expected to do. The idea of the bold, free life led by these men so fired my imagination, even as the tender glances from the dark eyes of the chief's daughter had inflamed my heart, that I expressed my desire to be admitted into the band in such happy language as to cause all the robbers to applaud my address, and welcome me as a worthy comrade. From this time the star of my destiny seemed rapidly in the ascendant. I was presented with a handsome young horse and a set of arms, and invited to test my prowess with those around me. In the mountain life of my childhood I had learned to ride and to excel in all those arts of horsemanship practiced by the hill tribes, and from the wandering soldier who had returned to our valley, I had learned to use my weapons as a soldier should. Thus I acquitted myself so well that I won yet further distinction. In very truth, my exhilaration at finding myself once more free, and mounted upon a swift horse able to fly like the wind across the plains, would well have helped me to surmount far greater difficulties than any I encountered, while all my natural instincts in favor of war and its arts awoke when I found myself no longer surrounded by peaceful shepherds or pious priests, but by those who made warfare their trade, and robbery and murder their profession. After this, I was able not only to hold my position with these robbers, but even to become so popular a favorite that I was finally chosen as the husband of the chief's daughter and successor to the chief, who, being rather old and somewhat lazy, and moreover having no son to succeed him, desired someone to relieve him of the more laborious part of his duties. Before my advent, the most likely candidate for this honor was a man named Haji, and it may readily be supposed that my rapid rise into favor was as gall and wormwood to him, and that all my attempts to conciliate him were in vain. This wife, who was thus bestowed unexpectedly upon me, and whose name was Dilfarib, was comely, but scarcely as beautiful as I had thought from the stray glimpses permitted to me when she had partly unveiled her face, and her beauty such as it was but the beauty whose charm is of youth. Her bold black eyes, her slim and cypress waist, her pink cheeks and long black hair, were distinctly charms of earth and not of heaven. She was a forward girl, and soon developed into a coarse woman. Her mind was dull, her intellect limited, her instincts petty and selfish, while her temper was decidedly waspish. Her strongest characteristics were a love, of dress and gossip. Her sentiment for me had been a passing fancy for a handsome youth different from those round her, and she soon wearied of me, as I did of her. She was utterly incapable of entering into any of my flights of fancy, or understanding the poetic glamour I sought to throw around my ideal of true love. She cared for me only so long as I fed her vanity with words of flattery, and her love of finery with handsome clothes. Very soon I wearied of her vulgar blandishments, while her want of refinement jarred upon me at every turn, and her charms palled upon my fastidious taste. Then, too, I grew tired of the paltry distinction of being a leader of a petty mountain tribe of ignoble marauders, thieves of other men's goods. The constant intriguing of Haji filled me with anger and contempt, and when my wife proceeded to say that she questioned whether, after all, Haji were not the better man of the two, and that she feared she had made a mistake in selecting me, I resolved to give her an early opportunity of trying him as my successor. The hills around me seemed to shut me in and stifle me, and I longed to go forth into the wide world once more and measure myself with other men, even with the great ones of the earth, that I might find where my true position was amidst the bustle of an active life, larger and broader in its interests than any I had yet known. I question whether at this time the sovereignty of the whole earth would have satisfied the cravings of that boundless ambition, which was awake within me, and I know the limits of the known universe would not have been wide enough to limit my incessant thirst for greater knowledge of every kind, especially for a knowledge of that unseen world of which I had beheld such wondrous glimpses, and whose mysteries I longed the more intensely each day to explore. For 2 years I lived amongst these mountain robbers, and during that time, no signs of pursuit had reached me, so that from the priests of Amurat, I now felt comparatively safe. My beard had grown full and thick, and with my change of dress so altered my appearance, that I scarcely feared recognition. I therefore resolved to take the first chance of leaving my present life, feeling very certain that my wife would soon console herself for my disappearance by wedding the artful Haji, whom I wished all joy of his acquisition. My opportunity soon came. We were sent to intercept a rich convoy of merchandise, sent from Bokhara to Tehran, to the king. We did not, however, win the easy victory we expected, for the king had armed his servants well, and sent, moreover, some soldiers to protect his goods, so that after a sharp fight, some of our band were killed and the rest took refuge in rapid flight, myself being one of the first to quit the field as soon as the melee had fairly begun. Once free from the hilly ground, I gave my horse free rein, and was soon galloping swiftly across the wide sandy plain. Chapter 6, The Tawais. Soon after midnight a silvery crescent moon rose in the sky, and by its light and that of the silver stars I rode on, till moon and stars began to pale and the grey dawn of another day appeared. All around me as far as the eye could reach there lay nothing but this wild wilderness of sand, rolling in undulating billows like waves upon the sea, while in the dim distance the hulls greater than which I had left far behind lay like faint blue specks on the horizon. I rode onward for some time, till as the scorching rays of the rapidly rising sun rendered further progress almost impossible, I drew near to a small clump of the trees, beneath whose scanty shade my horse and I lay down together to rest. When I awoke the sun had already set, and the grey shadows of approaching night were gathering fast over the desert, for so far south was I there was but little twilight. To me the evening hour has always been a time when a sense of mystery and awe steals over the soul, and fills it with the subtle suggestion of strange and unknown things, whose shapeless forms, hovering in the air, unseen yet not unfelt, are akin and yet different to ourselves. As I led my horse from beneath the trees, I beheld before me two paths, stretching across the desert, where path there was none. The one bright and shining as though paved with snow-white stones led to the westward, as though to follow the track of the setting sun. The other path stretched towards the south, and its outline was dim, misty, and dark. At the parting of the ways stood two figures, like unto angels with wings, the spirits of the light and dark spheres. The one who stood upon the shining path was like a fair young man, his robes white and sparkling as with silver stars. All was fair and open to behold. The way seemed easy, and it led to lands of glorious silver light on the far horizon. The other spirit was dim, indistinct, and shrouded with a somber veil. His face was half averted, and with one hand he drew his mantle over it, while with the other he beckoned to me. This figure seemed to express to me power, majesty, the successful pursuit of forbidden knowledge, the satisfaction of ambition, the glowing passion of gratified desires. His shadowy half-averted face drew me to him with an intense longing to rush forward and uncover that shrouded countenance, that I might gaze upon the mysteries, be they beautiful or horrible, blessed or accursed, which he thus hid from me. And as I involuntarily took a step forward towards him, my choice seemed made, the figures vanished, and to the south I resolved that I would go. It was as though the good and evil influences of my life had contended with each other for dominion over my soul, and for the time the evil had won. Many times as I rode southward was I tempted to turn back, but as often did I put the thought away from me and ride on. For good or ill, I was fated to taste of that knowledge whose mysteries the angel of darkness had half revealed and half hidden my sight. Chapter 7, Jalaluddin the Sorcerer. For 4 nights I rode on, resting always during the heat of the day, and on the morning of the 5th day, I beheld the towers and walls of a large city rising in the far distance. I was so overjoyed at this that I spread out my arms and bowed low upon my horse's neck in a salutation of welcome to it, and hurrying on my wearied steed I was able to reach it ere midday. I had never been in a city before, I had seen nothing larger than a mountain village. For although in my journey to the temple of Amurat from the Caucasian mountains, I had passed near the royal city of Tehran, the priests in whose charge I travelled had not permitted me to enter the walls. As soon, therefore, as I had enjoyed a short rest and attended to the welfare of my horse, I sallied forth to explore the wonders of the place, and after wandering for some hours through the narrow streets, I found myself at sunset on the outskirts of the city, and in front of the temple, which stood upon a slight eminence and was approached by a long flight of handsome steps. I ascended these that I might gain a last glimpse of the sinking sun, but I did not venture to enter the doors, fearing that I might be recognized, and also because I had an uneasy half-belief that were I, an apostate who had laid violent hands upon an anointed servant of the gods, to venture within the sacred precincts, some terrible vengeance of the offended deity would be visited upon me. I therefore hurried down the steps again without delaying to take more than one look at the sun, and was crossing the open ground with head bent down when the shadow of a man fell across the path before me, and a voice saluted me in very good Pahlavi but with the accent of a stranger. Somewhat startled, I looked up, and beheld a man of about 40 who was utterly unknown to me, and whose countenance repelled even while it attracted me. He was dressed in a robe of very dark silk, bordered with red and yellow stripes. On his head he wore a close-fitting white cap, with long lappets hanging to the shoulders striped with narrow bands of black. A narrow band of black passed round the head, and on the top there was a crescent-shaped ornament of gold, with a spike rising from the middle, and having a curious resemblance to 3 horns. In his hand he carried a long black wand, tipped with gold. His complexion was almost black, and his large brilliant black eyes seemed to glow with a somber fire that had no softness in their depths. His lips were full, his features high and of the Assyrian type, while a long straight blade beard covered and concealed his cheeks and chin. As I regarded him with some surprise and uneasiness, he spoke again, saying, "Nay, start not, nor question whether I mean harm to you. I come rather to befriend, and to offer you a home in this strange city, if you dost care to listen to a proposal I would make for your benefit and mine own. Marvel not that I sought you out, for, behold, I can read your future, even as I have read in part your past. The book of destiny is an open page before mine eyes, and in it I perceive that you shall someday sit upon an emperor's throne, even as you wearest now an emperor's chain around your neck. Yea, do I also see that 2 of its links are missing? Skillfully you hast joined them again. The broken chain is, methinks, an ill omen of your success, but I cannot behold your end as yet." Involuntarily I put my hand to my bosom to feel for the chain, which I wore most carefully concealed there, but no part of it was visible, and I was but the more startled by the man's knowledge of it, and I said, "What is it to you, O stranger, whose gold I wear? Why art you concerned with the business of another?" He gave a low sardonic laugh that had no mirth in it, as he replied, "Because the star of your destiny has crossed the path of mine, and I know that we are fated to learn much more of each other."